Today is November 4th, 2012, and this is the seventh of our eight classes on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. So in practicing, you know, mindfulness of the objects of mind, there are a number of definitions for that, and one is sort of the categories of phenomena, which to me is the patterns that the Buddha used to describe the way the world works. As we know, the Buddha was not proposing a belief system. He was describing his experience, and he asked us all to then use our powers of investigation to explore our own experience of life. So that's why we have such an emphasis on mindfulness, which is basically waking up and being present so we can investigate, you know. And as Nancy was saying, one of our key tools is the ability to suspend judgment, you know. And we need that in order to investigate with openness. And it's also kind of, like Nancy was saying, it's kind of a relief to just have a certain period of time where we can just suspend judgment about things. Knowing that we can go back to being judging, you know. There's some familiarity and some sort of comfort that we derive from that, obviously. But just to practice suspending our judgment is quite a wonderful thing. So what I'd like to do today is to sort of have two parts to the class. One is to review very briefly some of the categories of phenomena that the Buddha and Thai proposes. And then second, to apply. You know, we want to really apply this practice. We want to learn and understand, but it really doesn't do us much good unless we really apply it to our daily lives. So I want to introduce a practice that will be one way to apply all of this. So Thich Nhat Hanh offers in our book this chapter called The Principles of the Practice of Mindfulness, which I have not seen anywhere else, and I've never heard him talk about. So I'm not sure where they came from, but they're kind of the core principles of this of mindfulness and kind of the heart of the Buddha's teaching. So they're really worth looking at. The first one he calls Dharma's Our Mind. And I'm wondering, you know, that's really about the fact that we are, our life experience comes from our sense organs, you know, from the sense organ, the sense object, and the consciousness, the mind being, you know, the sixth organ. So really all of our life experience comes from that, and I read you the sutra on the all, where the Buddha gave that and basically said, this is it, folks. So that's the first one. The second one is to observe is to be one with the object of observation. This is it smacks a little bit of quantum physics, because, you know, which says that you can't observe something without changing it. Thai says about this, mindfulness is the observing mind, but it does not stand outside of the object of observation. It goes right into the object and becomes one with it. Because the nature of the observing mind is mindfulness, the observing mind does not lose itself in the object, but transforms it by illuminating it. Just as the penetrating light of the sun transforms trees and plants. So we talked about this last week, about mindfulness is the light that illuminates, it shines on everything, and just by that light it begins to heal and transform. And mindfulness is also what keeps us from getting sucked in to the story, into the suffering. It's our anchor. You know, the shamans say when you go in a journey of transformation, you always maintain the 1% shaman, 1% awareness, an awareness that you are bigger than the story, you know. we can bring this right home to our breath. You know, when we observe our breath, if our breath is calm, our body is calm. You know, our breath is a reflection of our mind and our body. So when we calm our breath, we're calming our mind, we're calming our body. So the third one is true mind and deluded mind are one. This is something that we really don't want to hear. We do not want to hear that the right-wing political party is one with the left wing. But without the right, there would be no left. So Thay talks about it wonderfully with the compost and the rose. You know, we need the suffering in order to create the beautiful rose. We need the compost in order, the fertilizer, to create the flowers and the vegetables. And that happiness is made of non-happiness elements. The rose is made of non-rose elements and sometimes non-beautiful elements. Sometimes it's made of really stinky elements. You wouldn't bring, you know, a big bucket of ripe compost and put it on your coffee table, you know. But really, it is the elements of the rose that you do put on your coffee table. So to have that kind of sight, that kind of insight into life, so that you don't have to push away, like Nancy says, what's unpleasant, what you have an aversion to. So that's what we practice. We practice, first of all, being aware of our reactions and then looking deeply and seeing, you know, we need that because it's part of our world and it makes the miracles. Makes what we want as well. The fourth one is the way of no conflict, which is kind of right in line with that third one. It's the practice of nonviolence and love. It's allowing space for that suffering to arise, you know, not having conflict with what we seem to want to push away. The ability to hold what we might consider confusing or even damaging in the space of love. And so we know with the light of mindfulness, that's the best way for it to transform. You know? And then the fifth one is observation is not indoctrination. And this is again speaks to our the Buddha telling us that we need to investigate for ourselves. What we're experiencing, what we know to be true, that we can't find this in a belief system that somebody's feeding us. And to do that, we have to know ourselves really well. You know, to know our experience, we have to hone our abilities to investigate, which means to show up, and then that's why we're doing this practice of what does non-aversion feel like? I'm experiencing non-aversion right now. What does it feel like? I'm experiencing non-grasping. I'm experiencing confusion. What does it feel like? And that just getting to know those processes allows us to get to know ourselves and then to trust our own selves, to trust our perception, to trust our experience, to have confidence in our ability to respond. And to review our intentions, you know. Why are we doing this? How do we want to spend our life? It helps us to wake up to being more conscious about our choices every day so that we can consciously become agents of healing rather than harming. You know, I don't think any of us walk out with the intention to do harm. But if we're not awake, it's inevitable. We're going to do harm, you know. So the more awake we can be, the more conscious we can be, probably the less harm we will create. And to me, again, what is so important is that in the story of the Buddha is the Buddha was a human being. You know, he's our model for us of an awake human being. There is nothing any more divine about him than about the rest of us. So, we talked earlier about Thay walking across a room. Well, you know, it's the same thing. The Buddha is our model of a human being just like us, who can be 100% awake, you know. And whether we get there in this lifetime or not, doesn't matter. It's just what we're doing right now, how we're choosing to spend this moment. That's our only choice that we have, really. So then we're going to move on to the four, to the categories of phenomena, that the main ones that the Buddha taught. And this was from his awakening. And, you know, you can only imagine what he saw in order to come up with this, these categories. Though his first teaching was the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. And in this, our sutra, it says, further bhikkhus, a practitioner remains established in the observation of objects of mind in the objects of mind with regard to the Four Noble Truths. How, bhikkhus, does the practitioner remain established in the observation of the Four Noble Truths? A practitioner is aware this is suffering as it arises. She is aware this is the cause of suffering as it arises. She is aware this is the end of suffering as it arises. She is aware this is the path which leads to the end of suffering as it arises. So that's kind of the real nutshell version of this practice. You know, there's the, we use the word suffering, but really the word is dukkha. And there's no accurate English translation of the word dukkha. I think suffering is pretty, probably not a great choice to, of translation, because what I've learned about the word dukkha is that it's equally, it speaks to equally mental and physical experience. So it's mental or physical, and it's not that strong. You know, suffering's really a strong word for us. It's just this sort of pervasive, to me, it's this pervasive unsatisfactoriness. Sort of this pervasive, you know how, and to me it's like, if you sit long enough, your butt's gonna go numb and you gotta stand up, you know. If you wait long enough, you're gonna get thirsty. If you drink too much, you're gonna have to urinate. You know, it's like there's always something that's kind of having, not, you know, you're comfortable for a while and then you're gonna get uncomfortable. You know, and to me it's just kind of this pervasive unsatisfactoriness that's there, and this is what, to me, the Buddha is speaking of. Usilananda had a nice metaphor. He says, just as a lamp performs four functions simultaneously, burning the wick, dispelling darkness, making light appear, and using oil, so this path penetrates suffering with full understanding, the origin of suffering with abandoning, the path with developing, and the cessation of suffering with realizing. So all these things are happening just through our awareness. So we can use the Four Noble Truths as the basis of a meditation. Larry Ward offered this, and so let's try that right now. Let's just do a short meditation. So connect with your breathing. Find a place in your body that's pleasurable to connect with your breath coming in and your breath going out. Become aware of a thought that comes to mind. And just observe that thought. And ask, does this thought cause suffering? You could say, is it part of grasping or aversion or confusion? Where did this thought come from? How do I work with it? And what is the method or the path to transforming this thought? So I really like just bringing those Four Noble Truths right to the moment. You know, just getting to know that little cycle of practice. And then the next category of phenomenon that the Buddha taught, which is really the Fourth Noble Truth, is the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the path out of dukkha, out of that feeling of unsatisfactoriness, of feeling that we aren't as we should be, the world isn't as it should be, that something needs to change. And I'm going to read two or three paragraphs from Thay just because he said it so succinctly. As we study and practice the Noble Eightfold Path, we see that each element of the path is contained within all the other seven elements. We also see that each element of the path contains the noble truths of suffering, the making of suffering, and the ending of suffering. Practicing the first noble truth, we recognize, we recognize our suffering and call it by its name, depression, anxiety, fear, or insecurity. Then we look directly into that suffering to discover its basis, and that is practicing the second noble truth. These two practices contain the first two elements of the Noble Eightfold Path, namely right view and right thinking. All of us have a tendency to run away from suffering, but now with the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path, we have the courage to face our suffering directly. We use right mindfulness and right concentration to look courageously at our suffering. The looking deeply that shows us clearly the basis of our suffering is right view. Right view will not show one reason for our suffering, but layers upon layers of causes and conditions, seeds we have inherited from our parents, grandparents, and ancestors, seeds in us that have been watered by our friends, and the economic and political situations of our country, and so many other causes and conditions. Now the time has come to do something to lessen our suffering. Once we know what is feeding our suffering, we find a way to cease ingesting that nutriment. Whether it is edible food, the food of sense impression, the food we receive from our intentions, or the food from our consciousness. We do this by practicing right speech, right action, and right livelihood, remembering that right speech is also listening deeply. To practice these three aspects, we take the mindfulness trainings as our guide. Practicing according to the mindfulness trainings, we see that when we speak, act, or earn our living, we do it with right mindfulness. Right mindfulness lets us know when we say something that is not right speech or do something that is not right action. Once right mindfulness is practiced, along with right diligence, right concentration will follow easily and give rise to insight or right view. In fact, it is not possible to practice one element of the Noble Eightfold Path without practicing all seven other elements. This is the nature of interbeing. And it is true for all of the teachings offered by the Buddha. So it's really a that's it in a nutshell, and I hope you get a feeling of the movement, the flow of the waves, you know, that circle around and feed us. So we can start anywhere, at any one of the doors, and if we walk in, we'll encounter all the rest of them eventually. And that, so the fourth noble truth is our path going forward. It's the way to express our awakening in this dualistic world that Robert was talking about, we live in. It's how to stay safe and how to be agents of healing instead of harming. So remember, I remember when I was young and how incredibly difficult it was to take the advice of my elders. I really didn't understand that they knew more than I did. I certainly didn't understand that I was mortal, you know. I didn't understand what was at stake, you know. There was a lot of things that could have made my life a lot easier if I had listened a little bit more, you know. So I feel like now we have another chance. These are our ancestors, our spiritual elders, and they're saying, you know, really, you know, this is the way to have a happy life. This is the way to be fulfilled and find your meaning and your truth. So I feel like I have another chance to listen. So that's what we're doing here. So the next and last category of phenomenon I just want to review a little bit is the five aggregates. And we've all worked with these. You know, we know the five aggregates are our form, our bodies, our feelings, our perceptions, how we see the world, our thoughts or mental formations, and our consciousness, kind of our whole construct. It's not, the teachings on the five aggregates is not philosophy, and it's not just a description. It's really the doorway to non-self, because the five aggregates is a description of us, and you know the aggregates, actually the word, the Pali word is skandhas, and which literally means heaps. So it's like we're just these five heaps of these elements. And I kind of love that because that starts me right off as with a little humility. So we notice, as we begin to notice these changes, these constant changes in our aggregates, our feelings, our bodies, our thoughts, you know, as we bring our investigative awareness, we just notice that they're constantly changing. And so, you know, it gets harder and harder to hold on to something that we call ourself. And this is kind of the whole idea. When we have no ownership of the aggregates, then we don't suffer when they change. And we know it's inevitable that they change. The Buddha said a few things about this. The Buddha said, whatever is not yours, abandon, and this will lead you to happiness. So if we give up, if we're able to let go of holding on to these false notions of who we are, what naturally arises is our true nature, which is compassion. Compassion is a wonderful way to live. And so that's what our true goodness is. Buddha says, when there's no self, there's no suffering. And so this is a process that deconstructs our notion of self. And the Buddha said, the self is not something we have to demolish or get rid of because it's not there in the first place. So the Buddha said, bhikkhus develop concentration. A bhikkhu who is concentrated understands things as they really are, and what is understood? The arising and passing of the aggregates. So this is a real key. All we have to do is tune in to how we bring our mindfulness to our feelings, and instead of being swept along by our feelings that are constantly changing, we become aware of the changing nature of our feelings. And that frees us from thinking that that's what we are. And the same thing with our thoughts, and the same thing with our bodies. So that's a tiny little nutshell of all the categories that the Buddha taught. And the second part of the class, I'd like to talk about, introduce a practice called the life review. This is a practice that's been described and developed by Stephen Levine, and he really wrote a lot about it in his book called A Year to Live. As you'll see, it has elements from many different traditions and practices, of course. It's a way to use our skills of careful and kind investigation to clear out our wrong perceptions, to clear out those hidden wounds that have energy and insight sort of locked inside us, waiting to be released so that we can have more energy and more enthusiasm and happiness, and so we can express ourselves more beautifully. So we do this. I'm going to just talk about it, and then I'm going to describe the process, and then we'll do it. And this is an offering for you to continue with for as long as you want, as much as it's worthwhile to you. So this is a way. This is a way to, first of all, of course, settle and become mindful and settled in our peaceful concentration, and then to invite in memories from your life, to greet them, to engage with them, and then to let them go, to say goodbye. Kind of like being to a class reunion. I know Dale went to a class reunion not too long ago, where you see people that and remember events that happened that you maybe haven't thought of for a really long time. And you can use writing or journaling to assist you in this process if you want to. I find it really helpful, but it doesn't have to be that way. Dr. Dan Siegel uses this kind of practice in his Wheel of Awareness, and he calls it mental time travel. So we do this to become free of the unconscious patterns of energy that influence how we see and respond to the world, that keep us separate, that keep us afraid or anxious. So this is a practice of freedom, of liberation. So it's important that we go into this consciously, that we make the choice to do this practice. You may be in a place right now where you're happy with how you are, and you're happy with where things are, and you don't want to stir anything up. You don't want to invite old memories to come up, and that's fair, honorable, you know. I believe that you can use this process very lightly, that you can just touch. It doesn't have to be a steamroller kind of event. But it's very important that you do it consciously so that there's no victim energy going on when you do this process. You need to bring your warrior energy, you know, which is the brave heart, the warrior of the heart, to this practice. So as Nancy was reminding us, just like with feelings, there are three types of memories: pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So we apply that, that observation of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral to these memories as they come up. Again, as a tool of mindfulness, as a tool of keeping us awake as we engage. So our clarity comes from our awareness of the changing states of mind. You know, we are aware of impermanence, that our past is alive in us, and that we can change it right now. We can change our past because our past is here with us. And also that the understanding non-self, that doing this work helps heal everyone. Like Janine was saying, we offer the merit of this personal practice to everyone, and we know that it ripples out and it affects everyone. That we're releasing when we release a painful memory, and letting go, we're releasing just a tiny bit of the pain that's being held in the world. You know, releasing it into the vast blue sky. That is our true nature, and letting it float free. The forgiveness, the forgiveness aspect comes. Excuse me. The forgiveness aspect of this practice comes from a heart that can no longer stand to be closed to itself or to anyone else. I remember years ago, there was a quote from Anais Nin about the bud had to open. The pain of being closed was stronger than the fear of opening, you know. So when it becomes time, you know, our hearts become ready. We need to engage in opening. A heart that wants to, that values freedom more than the need to disguise the pain. So the process begins with exercising our generosity, but its purpose is really to help us let go of our own suffering. Which the Buddha said was the hardest work we'd ever do. Now we really hold on to it. Thay speaks about compassion, and he says, when we suffer, we have a tendency to blame another person because he has acted like that, because she has acted like that, because he has said that, or because she has said that. That is why I suffer. But we never say that because I have not had enough freedom in me, that's why I suffer. Yes, we suffer because we don't have enough freedom. If we have enough freedom, then we have enough compassion. If the other person suffers and says things and does things not to our liking, it is because he also lacks happiness and peace. And the only correct response is to be compassionate to him or her. Therefore, the practice is to be free. So when we're free enough to ask ourselves, where is this person hurting? Instead of by reacting or pushing back or away, by defending ourselves, then we're free. Our container of love grows.